morning. I'm Matt Schaefer. Welcome back to the Boston Sunday Review. The 1964 murder of Washington socialite Mary Pinchot Meyer has never been solved. Now, Peter Janney offers a fascinating and frightening solution to this 50-year-old mystery in his new book, Mary's Mosaic, and Peter Janney joins us here this morning on the BSR. Good morning.
Good morning, Matt. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the victim, Mary Pinchot Meyer. She was from a wealthy, politically connected Pennsylvania family, unusually beautiful and talented.
Yes, some people think that she was arguably one of the most beautiful women of an entire generation. You know, she came from the Pinchot family, which they were New Yorkers, and they summered in Milford, Pennsylvania. Her uncle, Gifford Pinchot, was a two-time governor of Pennsylvania. Her father, Amos Pinchot, was one of the co-founders of the American Civil Liberties Union, and of course, a very prominent figure in Teddy Roosevelt's Bull Moose Party.
She marries this guy named Cord Meyer, who is a brilliant young World War II veteran, considered by many one of the brightest lights of his generation.
Yes, Cord emerged from World War II. He came back wounded. He lost an eye in a battle out in the Pacific, and he completely did an about face. He had always sort of had pacifist undercurrents, and I think when he lay almost dead on the beach of Okinawa, he realized that he had made a huge mistake, that he should have become a conscientious objector to the war. But in any case, he came back and he turned an about face and he started to devote his life to becoming a post-World War II peacenik. He really wanted never to see the specter of war encroach on our planet.
Mary and Cord are very much involved with a group called the World Federalist Movement. What's that?
Well, the United World Federalists came out of post-World War II, and Cord and Mary had gone to the first UN conference in 1945 in San Francisco. And feeling that even there, the UN was not going to be given the kind of power it needed to sort of police the world away from war, Cord and a number of other very well-known people of that era embarked on this organization called the United World Federalists, which really wanted to have the kind of power that could stop armed conflict before it became a conflagration of some kind.
So given that kind of personal commitment to a scheme like this, how does and why does Cord Meyer go to work for the CIA?
Well, Cord worked very hard for 2 to 3 years on the United World Federalists. And at the end of that time in the late 1940s, I think he was exhausted. I think he was discouraged. We were coming into the Cold War, and it was clear that the United World Federalists, its tenure was not going to, in a sense, have the reign that they hoped it would be. So Cord, in searching for something to do, he went back to Harvard to, I think, finish his doctorate, because he was a Lowell Fellow at Harvard, a very distinguished position to have. But then he got seduced by Alan Dulles, and in the early 1950s joined the CIA.
He reportedly heads up Operation Mockingbird, which is designed to influence foreign and domestic media.
Yes, and that was Mockingbird was a creation of one of Cord's colleagues, Frank Wisner. And when Cord began to assume the helm of that particular operation, he really took it to an entirely new level. He was very effective in a sense getting the CIA point of view into the media, whether it be print journalism or any other kind of journalism. That was its goal. The CIA wanted to use Mockingbird as a way to control the dissemination of information to the public.
He goes over to the dark side.
I think there's no other way to say it, Matt. That's exactly what happened.
Cord and Mary Meyer's marriage was in trouble, and it was rocked, furthermore rocked, in 1956 when their son Michael was killed crossing a highway behind their home.
Yes, I knew Michael very well. He was my best friend at the time. This was really my forage into the family.
This is a world that you know intimately. Your dad, Wister. Wister Janney was top echelon CIA.
Yes, he was a close colleague of, you know, all the major players, Richard Helms, Jim Angleton, Tracy Barnes.
So you grew up in this atmosphere of sort of privilege and secrets.
I was what was known as a CIA brat. As many of my contemporaries whose fathers worked at the agency were referred to sometimes.
Your parents socialized with Myers and other CIA elite, and you hung out at the Myers home because their kid was your best friend before he was killed.
And we went to school together. We sat side by side for 2 years in the same classroom. And we were inseparable and very, very close.
With the death of their son, that actually sort of portended the death of their marriage. Mary and Cord Meyer divorce. And in your new book, Mary's Mosaic, you investigate Mary Pinchot Meyer's murder. It's Washington, D.C., the early 1960s. John F. Kennedy is president, and Mary begins an affair with JFK.
Yes, Mary and Jack Kennedy actually met in 1936. She was 15 years old. He had just graduated from the Choate School, and he came back.
They met at a Choate School dance. He was a graduate.
He was already a graduate.
And she was a babe.
Oh, she was the babe. I mean, she was very stunning. And I think that was the moment where she took JFK's breath away, although at that time no real significant relationship ensued, but they were introduced to each other, and they did keep sort of bumping into each other all through college.
And so as president, they not only as president, they're neighbors before he is elected president. So their paths are crossing all the time. And he, as we all now know, JFK was a womanizer. And at some point after he is elected president, he gets Mary Pinchot Meyer in bed.
I actually think it probably likely took place before that, not too much before that, but I would say right after the election. According to Kenny O'Donnell, in terms of what he told the late author Leo Damore, Mary was a fixture around the White House almost immediately after they had moved in.
After the divorce, she is working on her art. She paints in a studio she rents from her sister Tony, and Tony's husband Ben Bradley, who is the editor of the Washington Post.
He wasn't editor of the Post at that time. He was actually the Washington Bureau Chief of Newsweek during that time. He became editor of the Post after the murder trial in 1965. That's when he went back to the Post.
JFK is assassinated in November 1963. 11 months later, Mary Pinchot Meyer is murdered on a Georgetown Canal towpath days after the publication of the Warren Commission.
That's right. Less than 3 weeks after the Warren Commission was released on September 24, 1964, Mary was murdered execution style on the CNO Canal towpath.
From the beginning, everything about this case is weird. Friends knew that Mary kept a tell-all diary. And James Angleton, the chief of CIA counterintelligence, is busting into her studio looking for it.
Well, the search from the diary We're probably never going to know all the logistics, but it's pretty clear that the diary was stolen either from her studio on the night of the murder or from her bedroom on the night of the murder. And there are two, I leave it to the reader to decide, but there are really two tributaries to that. In any case, James Angleton absconds with the diary and takes possession of a lot of her personal papers, letters reportedly from JFK that were sort of a love letter type thing, and he takes, in a sense, the last years of her life back to the Central Intelligence Agency with him.
There's a rush to judgment by the government to try the alleged murderer, an African American named Raymond Crump. There's no physical evidence.
Not only is it there no physical evidence, there's not a shred of forensic evidence that links Mr. Crump either to the body of Mary Pinchot-Meyer or to the crime scene itself. And it was a fairly bloody crime scene, according to what the court transcript says in terms of what police discovered. So it's just really impossible that Ray Crump could have committed this crime for the reasons that I've just said, as well as a number of other reasons.
He's got an amazing attorney who early on comes to recognize that really Raymond Crump isn't the kind of guy to kill anybody. I mean, he's sort of a Casper Milquetoasty kind of guy.
He's a slip of a man, very slight build. He did not match the description that was given on the police radio 251 code that was broadcast immediately after the murder. And when Dubby Roundtree, the attorney, who became, by the way, just a legendary African-American woman attorney in Washington, there's a book written about her by Katie McCabe called Justice Older Than the Law. Dubby Roundtree becomes the star at this point in terms of keeping the government from being able to bury this case. She takes it pro bono. He pays her $1.25. She risks her entire professional reputation as well as considerable financial resources to defend this man.
So the jury acquits Crump and the crime remains officially unsolved. In your new book, Mary's Mosaic, you claim, among other things, that Mary Pinchot-Meyer had a closer relationship with JFK than is generally known.
I think this was really a potential relationship of redemption for JFK. I mean, we all know that, in today's parlance, JFK would be labeled as kind of a sex addict. He had a lot of problems with intimacy with women. But Mary Meyer became one of his trusted allies and friends. And I think he really began to understand what it meant to be in love with someone. And in fact, he told his presidential advisor, Kenny O'Donnell, in the fall of 1963, that after he got out of the White House, he wanted to divorce Jackie so that he could be with Mary Meyer.
You claim Mary Meyer had been experimenting with LSD with Timothy Leary here in Cambridge and may have actually tripped with the president.
Mary's forage into psychedelics really started to begin in the late 1950s. I think most people need to be reminded that LSD was sort of on the vanguard of the avant-garde, particularly in artistic communities. It was very popular. People like Cary Grant, other Hollywood figures were very intrigued by this and believed that it had changed their life. Mary's position was, once she had explored this, she felt that it could be a critical event for world political leaders if they had this kind of experience. She believed that it would further evolution of humanity towards world peace.
Possibly as a result of these experiments and altered consciousness, and certainly as a reaction to the Bay of Pigs and Cuban Missile Crisis, JFK, you say in your book, planned to embark on a plan to end the Cold War, as he spelled out in his commencement address to American University in June 1963.
I think the turning point was really the Cuban Missile Crisis in the fall of 1962. As Jim Douglas, the author of JFK and the Unspeakable, once wrote, this was the most dangerous moment in all of human history. And I think coming out of the Cuban Missile Crisis, both Khrushchev and President Kennedy, who were already wanting to align themselves toward world peace initiatives, really felt that they had to get to work and start to make some things happen in that direction.
For JFK to end the Cold War, such an action threatened, you charge, both the military-industrial complex of this country and the CIA.
That's right. As Arthur Schlesinger once remarked with regard to his tenure in the Kennedy administration, he once said we were at war with our own national security apparatus. And I think what he meant by that was that the CIA was learning pretty quickly that they weren't going to be able to control President Kennedy like they had, for instance, President Eisenhower, even Truman to some degree. And so it became clear that Kennedy really wanted to go off on his own independent political trajectory away from the Cold War toward world peace initiatives. And in the summer of 1963, lo and behold, he and Khrushchev secretly negotiate this limited nuclear arms treaty, all behind the backs of the Pentagon brass and the CIA. And this was just unheard of.
So Mary's mosaic continues. The CIA launches a plan to assassinate the president and blame the murder on Lee Harvey Oswald.
I think it's possibly one of the biggest events in all of American history. And as we come into the 50th anniversary of this next year, particularly, Matt, I think it's time as a country to have a new awakening and a new reckoning with regard to what actually took place. In a sense, you know, I feel like our country has been stolen from us. We are not allowed as citizens to know the real truth of our country. And that is not only tragic, it's inherently dangerous because we're destined to make the same mistakes over and over again if we don't have the truth.
This occurred with the knowledge and approval of Lyndon Johnson. And you argue that the cover-up began immediately at Parkman Hospital and used all the resources of Operation Mockingbird to influence the media.
Yes. I think what another very important fact that the public, I don't think, really realizes that JFK's body actually showed up at the Bethesda morgue 20 minutes before the official motorcade arrived, allegedly carrying JFK's body in a bronze casket. The casket was empty. His body was already at the morgue undergoing postcranial postmortem surgery to make sure all evidence of frontal wounds were removed from his body so that it could be unequivocally given to the public that the shots had all come from behind the motorcade by Lee Harvey Oswald from the Texas School Book Depository.
And the Zapruder film was altered to make sure that it was on the same path.
Nearly 50 people in Daley Plaza on the day of the assassination remember that the motorcade came to an almost complete stop, or in fact, a complete stop, right before the fatal headshot to the president. And it was things like this that had to be removed from the Zapruder film, as well as some other details. And so we now have the factual knowledge of there being two Zapruder film events, one that took place Saturday night, the day after the assassination, and one that took place Sunday night, 2 days after the assassination, clearly indicating that the film had been altered.
Mary Meyer, you charge, knew that the conclusions of the Warren Commission were utterly fiction. James Angleton and other top CIA feared that if Mary went public or to Bobby Kennedy with her feelings about this and what she knew, then the entire cover-up might fall apart.
I think Angleton and others within the CIA were clearly very, very concerned about Mary's capability. This was a very headstrong, independent woman who was not afraid to stand up and be counted. And it's my understanding that she had made the decision to go public after the Warren Commission came out because she was just outraged by what was taking place. She was going to reveal the fact of her affair with the president and what she had discovered in that year during 1964, where she put the pieces together in her own mosaic of what had taken place, and that mosaic ended up at the doorstep of the Central Intelligence Agency.
So you believe they ordered a CIA hit on Mary Pinchot Meyer, and the hitman actually testified at the Raymond Crump trial as a witness for the prosecution?
Correct. This gentleman by the name of...
Wow.
Yeah, it's larger than life, isn't it? I mean, this guy, William L. Mitchell, who testified at the trial, shows up at the police station the day after the murder and says, you know, I think I ran by this woman, and it must have been right before she was murdered yesterday. And, oh, by the way, I saw this black guy following her. And, of course, he gives an almost identical description of Raymond Crump that this guy Henry Wiggins gave, who had been lured to the scene to make sure that someone witnessed the aftermath of this murder. This is how intricately well planned this assassination was.
A portion of your book, your work, is based on the work of journalist Leo Damore, who wrote a best-selling book on Chappaquiddick.
Correct. Leo Damore actually wrote several books, the last of which was Senatorial Privileged, which was published in 1988. And it was sort of the tell-all story of what had happened to Senator Ted Kennedy at Chappaquiddick. But Leo's real interest at that point was that he wanted to get back to the Mary Meyer story, because before presidential assistant Kenny O'Donnell had died, Leo had been able, Leo knew Kenny, and he had asked Kenny to sit down with him and talk about Mary, at which point Kenny did that, and they talked at some length. And it was really Kenny O'Donnell who told Leo about Jack's fascination with Mary and what had taken place in the White House and how important she had become to the president. And that, in fact, Kenny O'Donnell was in some ways very threatened by Mary, in the sense that he realized she had a lot of power over him. Her opinion mattered.
Leo claims to have actually spoken with the hitman.
That's right. Without going into a great deal of detail about that, they did finally have a conversation late one night in which Leo tape recorded the call. And then several hours later, on March 31st, 1993, at about 8:30 in the morning, he called his attorney, James H. Smith of Falmouth, Massachusetts, who's still alive and still extremely cogent. And he told his attorney, Jimmy Smith, what had taken place. And Mr. Smith, being the lawyer that he was, pulled out his yellow pad and took six pages of notes on the call and saved them, at which point, several years ago, actually back in 2004, he gave me the notes. And this, of course, the notes become one of the appendices, part of the appendices in my book. But it documents what Mr. Damore shared with his attorney on that telephone call.
In putting together a timeline of the case, you uncovered inconsistencies about how and when Ben Bradley, who was Mary Pinchot Meyer's brother-in-law, subsequently became the editor of the Washington Post and the primary mover behind the Watergate coverage. Also a person whom you say had and likely has CIA ties. You discovered inconsistencies about how and when Bradley found out about the murder. You discovered that someone from the CIA called Bradley to tell him about Mary's murder before the body had been identified by police. And that person from the CIA was?
My father, Wister Janney. And it's a remarkable story, and one that I had never really put together until I was deep into the research for this book. Your listeners must understand that there is no court record, no trial document that ever says anything about Ben Bradley getting a call from my father within 2 hours after the murder took place and Mary's identity still being unknown to police. This only happened in terms of what Mr. Bradley wrote in his memoir 30 years later in 1995. He brings my father into the situation. And in that memoir, he also says this was how he first discovered that his sister-in-law had been murdered. Whereas in the court transcript, we are led to believe that it's not until Sergeant Sam Wallace shows up at his house a little bit before 6 p.m. on the evening of the murder to tell Mr. Bradley that he thinks his sister-in-law is in the morgue and would he come and identify the body.
Throughout your investigation, you encountered people still afraid to talk 50 years later and found that many people with knowledge of this case had died under possibly questionable circumstances.
Yes, you know, I think one of the more disturbing results of writing this book is a real understanding that if someone gets to be too much of trouble within the national security apparatus, they can be easily eliminated. And the epilogue of my book is, in a sense, concerned with this matter. I tell the story of Joe Scheinman, who was my father's age, and his daughter, Toni Scheinman, who's my age. And Mr. Scheinman worked secretly for the CIA and actually was an assassin for them when it became necessary. And in the epilogue, Toni Scheinman tells me a number of relevant details about her father, and they talk about the Mary Meyer murder, and Mr. Scheinman tells his daughter why she had to be eliminated, although he was not himself part of this specific operation.
When Cord Meyer was dying, someone asked him, "Who killed your wife?" And he said, "The same sons of bitches who killed JFK."
Allegedly, that's what he said. We have no tape-recorded record of that. The author who purports that to be true was an author by the name of C. David Heyman, who just recently died. And I interviewed Mr. Heyman, but I could never get any real evidence. He had no tape recording of Cord having said that. It is, however, fascinating that Cord's personal secretary was also quoted as saying that Cord never believed that Mary was her death was the result of a random act of violence. He believed that it had, as she said, all the markings of a CIA rubout.
Mary Pinchot Meyer's diary has never been found. But to learn what may be inside that diary, you need only read Mary's Mosaic by Peter Janney. It's published by Skyhorse Publishing, and you can visit marysmosaic.net to learn more. Peter Janney, it's been fascinating to speak with you.
Great to be with you this morning, Matt. Thank you for having me.
And you are listening to the Boston Sunday Review.